Please be advised that this serving of AIDS, the Lost Voices, may cause offense or upset, as...
I've got a bit of a potty mouth. I mean, I can't help it. Well, I can help it, but you know, this subject just gets me so fired up that the odd swear word just falls out every now and again. Anyway, if you've got sensitive ears, or you're around people with sensitive ears, then perhaps tune in later. Don't tune in at all. Pop in some headphones. I don't give a f***. Anyway, let's get this show started. Roll it.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to Extra Tea with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s, and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it.
Hey, Glorious.
Hey.
So we're back for another week. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, good, good.
I've fully dried out from last week.
Because for anybody who didn't listen to last week's episode, shame on you. We got caught in Soho after a bit of brunch in a downpour. But good old British weather, given we've gone from downpours from late July to this amazing heatwave in the space of a week. Although I've not seen much sunshine, as I've spent most of this week down in the archives.
I know. You dropped me a few messages complaining about another sort of damp patch.
Damp patch? Yes. Oh, gosh, yes. There is, how can I put it? Often, but not always, I should stress, not always, but a very specific type of person that hangs out in the archives. Often the one that, perhaps... doesn't believe in deodorant, you know, the type that buys vegan shower gel but doesn't use the shower gel regularly because they want to save water and save the planet.
Wow.
And this episode took me to the Bishopgate's archives in East London, and there were, I have to say, a few sweaty Bettys in there. You know who you are if you're listening, and it just wasn't pleasant.
Nice. And you just mentioned East London, where this first article we're looking at from the Liverpool Daily Post takes us to London's East End.
Your serious tone started to make me sweat a little
bit. No way.
Oh,
really?
Anyway, right, let's get out to business, because you're right. The late Diana, Princess of Wales, visited the Mildmay Mission Hospital in the East End of London, and it housed the country's first AIDS hospice. And the princess had visited on the 24th of February, 1989.
And the national newspapers didn't cover the story?
Well, they did and they didn't, because what they didn't do was they didn't run a story on the photo opportunity and the photograph that naturally arose from the visit. For example, the Daily Mirror instead reported on how the princess was reunited with nurse Shane Snape.
Yeah.
Now, the pair had previously met when the princess officially opened the Broderick Ward in 1987, so 2 years earlier. Shane Snape was a nurse working on the Broderick Ward when it opened, and the princess came to officially open the ward, and the two had met. And it was significant because it was reported in the media that Shane was also, while a nurse, also living with HIV.
Uh-huh.
And now here he is working as a training officer, but he has connections with Mildmay Hospital, so the pair meet at the hospital.
So, the Liverpool Daily Post, on February 25th, 1989, prints a large photo of the late Princess Diana receiving a bouquet from a young man in a shirt and glasses. The strapline reads, "Royal support for AIDS victims."
That's right. And the man in the photograph with Diana, Princess of Wales, is 34-year-old Martin Johnson, who we'll get to hear more about in this article,
okay,
which reads, "The Princess of Wales spent an hour talking to seriously ill AIDS victims yesterday and left with their heartfelt thanks for her help in trying to break down the prejudice sufferers face. The princess, who earlier this month cuddled a toddler dying of AIDS in a New York City hospital, was visiting the Mildmay Mission Hospital AIDS Hospice in East London."
This was a highly publicized tour the princess made to Harlem, New York City on February 3rd, 1989, meeting children dying as a result of AIDS.
Yes, the tour was said to be a huge success, but there is no escaping that the Diana, Princess of Wales, was so moved when she visited these children with AIDS that there are a few articles that I've added to the blog along with these. And the article with the Liverpool Daily Post on Diana's visit to the Mildmay Mission Hospital continues with a quote from their medical director. "She wanted to come. We did not invite her. It was her idea," said an official. "The princess, who has been at the forefront of the battle against AIDS in Britain, sat on the edge of the beds of four men patients in their 30s and 40s, holding their hands. The hospice's medical director, Dr. Veronica Moss, said afterwards, 'She is facing the facts and she knows she is not going to catch the disease by being sympathetic in that way. It was totally real. She didn't do it just for effect.' Martin Johnson, 34, a former tour company rep told her, quote, "We are certainly grateful that you are taking an interest in us, especially after what you did in New York."
It goes to show the attention she drew to issues such as HIV/AIDS.
She was able to manipulate the media to her advantage and to the advantage of some of the causes that people were unwilling to talk about, and HIV/AIDS was one of them. And, you know, her visit here, her first visit to the Mild Mary Mission Hospital, she's invited the press. She knows it's going to make all the newspapers.
Yeah.
So it's going to raise awareness. And again, it's another photograph where she's seen shaking hands with Martin Johnson. And the article goes on to state, "The princess, noting Martin's outsized red-rimmed glasses, declared with a grin, 'I like your glasses.' Later, Martin, pictured above with the princess, held up his £15 glasses for photographers and said, 'These were a sensation for a lovely woman.'"
And on the same day, the Newcastle Journal, with the same photograph, reported, "The hospice's medical director, Dr. Veronica Moss, said afterwards, 'She soon broke the ice. What she is doing is tremendously important. She is facing the facts, and she knows she is not going to catch the disease by being sympathetic in that way."
Mm. And while the princess and Martin have a chat from a pair of armchairs on the ward, they quote Martin as telling the princess, quote, "I am one of the lucky ones. I am still mobile and can get around. This hospice has given me back the will to live."
From that statement, it sounds as though Martin living with AIDS has at some point felt he didn't have the will to live.
Yeah, it sounds so. And really, who can blame him? Because there's many other men and women that are in the same position. It's 1989. There's no effective treatment. So you can understand why Martin wouldn't have the will to live. Mm. There's no escaping that this is a hospice. So I can't help but feel that he knows what the ending is going to be. You can see Martin's diagnosis on his face. You know, there are small purple patches behind his beard, on the tip of his nose, his cheeks, and across his forehead, and often abbreviated as KS. This is Kaposi sarcoma. Now, the MayoClinic.org defines KS as, "Kaposi sarcoma is a type of cancer that forms in the lining of blood vessels and lymph vessels. The cancer forms growths of cells called lesions on the skin. The lesions often form on the face, arms, and legs. The lesions may look pink, red, purple, or brown."
Martin, I saw in our production notes that AIDS patients could be shown how to use makeup to hide any visible KS.
Indeed, and given it's the Princess of Wales, Diana Princess of Wales, Martin is either hasn't had any of this training, or merely isn't going to try and hide what is happening to him.
Yeah.
And I found some footage of the visit where, for only a few seconds, Martin is seen and heard from the BBC camera in the press pack at the side of Martin. The camera is focused on the bouquet that Martin is holding, ready to present to the princess. It is made up of canary yellow roses, white roses, and baby's breath. And I also read that symptoms of KS, no matter where they are located, can impact an individual's legs and feet. And a member of the press can be heard asking Martin, who is sitting, if he will stand or remain seated when he presents the princess with the bouquet. I assume so they can plan their shot. You can hear Martin, in his London accent, confirming he will stand when he sees the princess arriving. Let's take a listen.
"No, I'll stand up and she presents and she comes through the door.
You're presenting somebody?"
"Yes."
Wow. It truly does bring Martin's story to life, hearing his voice.
Doesn't it? And the footage of Martin is on the blog, so you can go take a look. And as Martin confirmed, he intends to stand when he sees the princess approaching. As the footage has a lot of background noise and it's only a few seconds long, I'll quickly run through what he said.
Okay.
As Diana, Princess of Wales, approaches with her arm outstretched, Martin says, "How do you do? Good morning." And they shake hands. The princess responds, "I've heard all about you." And as the press reported, Martin replies, "We're certainly grateful that you are taking an interest in us." The clip is cropped and we see Diana talking to the nurses gathered at the side of Martin, who sat in a chair, no doubt unable to stand for long periods. As the princess is laughing with the nurses, you see and hear Martin jokingly saying, "Don't listen to a word they say, don't listen." I suspect the princess, as she was known, perhaps asked if Martin was a good patient, or given his outgoing personality, if he was perhaps a little bit of a handful. A nurse is heard saying, sometimes, before a burst of laughter. So let's take a listen.
"How are you? How are you? All grateful, so grateful. Don't listen to a word they say,
don't
listen." It's hard to believe Martin is just 34 years old.
Just 34, and he's got his whole life ahead of him. But this was not the first time that Martin was in the media spotlight.
Okay, Jessica Fletcher, what's on the typewriter?
Jessica Fletcher. Okay, so let's rewind 6-7 years.
Okay.
It's the 21st of October, 1982, and on the front page of the Acton Gazette is the headline, "Gay Party is Raided by Police," and the strapline reads, "Protests follow as 37 men are arrested." And the article states, "Police have arrested 37 men after a raid on a gay party in Bedford Park. Guests from the all-male party were taken to Acton Police Station and held overnight after questioning. Although the men have now been released, at least 6 must return to the police station to learn if they will face charges under the 1967 Sexual Offences Act. Details of the case have been sent to the Director of Public Prosecution to decide if any action should be taken." A police spokesman said they had been called to the party in Esmond Road because they had received a complaint that sexual offences involving males under the age of 21 were taking place. He refused to comment on reports that the complaint was made by a guest at the party who was either refused entry or thrown out. Up to 12 uniformed officers are believed to have been involved in the raid. 6 men in the bedroom of the house are said to have been immediately arrested. Also arrested was host Martin Johnson. And inset into the article is a photograph, a headshot of Martin Johnson, and they caption it, "The host."
Firstly, did the police not have anything better to do? You can't find one police officer in London these days, let alone 12. And secondly, were men not allowed to have a social gathering in their homes back in 1982 London?
Yes, and the fact that they all rushed to a house party when today you have to wait 24, 48 hours if you've been stabbed.
Exactly.
Especially in London. But we shouldn't fall into the journalist's trap by assuming that it's an orgy.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what they're trying to say. Because they've whacked "gay party" in the headline.
Yes, because the 6 men in the bedroom could have been admiring the Anaglypta.
Do you know, that's only making me laugh because there's going to be a whole generation of listeners going, "What's an Anaglypta?"
You're such a shady bitch.
Probably going to think it's the name of a drag queen in the summer, which I think there is a drag queen called Anaglypta.
Really?
But anyway, there's going to be only one way to find out. Let's read the rest of the article. And we got up to the point where the newspaper article states, "Also arrested was host Martin Johnson." The article goes on to state, "A spokesman for the West London homosexual rights group, the London Monday Group..."
Oh dear.
What's the... Oh, I don't even know why. Jeez. I'm laughing. Right, let's try that again. So we go up to... "Also arresting was host Martin Johnson." I just don't know why they called it the London Monday Group.
Mm.
Actually, if anybody knows, then give us a shout.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, let's get back to business. Come on, we're doing this for Martin. "Also arrested was host Martin Johnson, a spokesman for the West London homosexual rights group, the London Monday Group. Said guests had complained of up to 15 people being kept in one cell and a policeman pushing pictures of naked men under the door."
No way.
The spokesman from the Gay London Monday Group, he said, "These arrests seem to have taken place under a very obscure piece of legislation. Other reports say police officers asked for the lights to be switched on and produced a torch."
Mm.
"Names, addresses and occupations of the guests were then taken. A number of guests have complained to the homosexual newspaper Gay News. The paper claims 9 men were kept in one cell, 13 in another and 15 in a third.
Wow.
It says they were forced to share one blanket in each cell and that a toilet was out of order. But a spokesman for Acton Police said he was not aware of any complaints about the men's treatment. He said, I know of no complaints. As far as I know, they were treated very civilly. At Acton Police Station, 37 guests were interviewed and later released on police bail. Several of the men were told to return on November the 6th. The arrests are believed to be the first time the 1967 Act has been applied to a private party. The Act only legalises homosexual acts in private between 2 consenting males over the age of 21.
So what is the issue here?
Well, the issue here is that This act is from 1967, when homosexuality was somewhat decriminalized. Legislation was amended to allow two men to engage in sex as long as they were 21 and over.
Okay.
And no more than two engaging in the act.
So Martin, having a house full of gay men, has attracted police attention.
Hmm, indeed.
So what happened next?
Well, I think the good thing for Martin and the 36 other men is I couldn't find any trace of this story hitting the tabloids or the national newspapers. But exactly 7 weeks later, on the 9th of December 1982, we get an update from the Acton Gazette with the headline, Gay Party Arrests, 37 Men Go Free. And there is a rather large headshot of Martin.
The article starts off by stating, police have dropped all action against 37 men arrested at a homosexual party in Bedford Park.
After 2 months of waiting, the men have now learned police have abandoned any plans to prosecute them for sexual offences.
This is interesting. I assume because they had no grounds, no evidence to be able to prosecute them.
Exactly, and we might learn more as the article continues. Now the host of the party, Martin Johnson, 28, has attacked the behaviour of the police and the laws on homosexuality. Acton police raided Mr. Johnson's flat in Esmond Road in October. All guests were arrested, including six in the bedroom.
Huh.
They were taken for questioning at Acton's police station and detained overnight. Mr. Johnson said the other guests at the party included customs officers, civil servants, and a school teacher. Two staff from the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions would have also been there, but their car broke down.
And who is the Director of Public Prosecutions?
Good question. So the UK government website states, the Director of Public Prosecutions, abbreviated to DPP, is the most senior public prosecutor in England and Wales and head of the Crown Prosecution Service, abbreviated as CPS. The DPP is appointed by and responsible to the Attorney General's office.
Okay.
However, at the time of the incident, the CPS weren't operating as they didn't start until 4 years after this incident in 1986. At the time of this incident in 1982, I believe the police would investigate and they would be the ones to decide whether to prosecute or not, perhaps often referring big, quote, big cases to the Director of Prosecution to decide if prosecuting is warranted.
So, if these two had arrived, it could have been embarrassing for the DPP's office, or maybe a few strings would have been pulled.
Oh, absolutely. From what we know retrospectively, what we've learned of how these kind of situations were dealt with back then, I'd imagine there would have been a few rope burns from some frantic string pulling, for sure. Although, we shouldn't fall into the trap of assuming that this social gathering, to quote the newspaper, of gay men is anything but an innocent gathering.
Good point.
And this article in the Acton Gazette continues by quoting Martin. He said, a lot of them were very worried. Many were worried that they would lose their jobs. What you do in private can affect what you do from 9 to 5.
Yeah.
The guests believe they would have been prosecuted under the 1967 Sexual Offences Act, which only legalises homosexuality between consenting adults. Any decision about taking court action would have been made by the Director of Public Prosecutions and fought as a test case for gay rights.
Ooh. Test case means a case brought to the court to set a precedent and test the legality of the law.
Exactly. And I guess the test here would be on the Sexual Offences Act 1967 and the act of two homosexuals or more gathering in a private home. Anyway, the article continues. Mr. Johnson said the last time there had been mass arrests was in the 1920s at a transvestite party. They thought they would be dealing with 37 frightened faggots, whereas in fact people stood up for themselves.
Wow. Is that true?
In terms of the mass arrests with the transvestites.
Yeah.
Well, talk about Jessica Fletcher. It took me a couple of hours to find the story in the newspaper archives. And given it was quite the sensation, I do believe that this is the story that Martin is referencing. Now, I have put the articles on the blog if anybody wants to read the full story, because it's quite an interesting story. But the case was heard at the Old Bailey because it was that scandalous in the day, in the 1920s. And the judge ordered the women out of the public gallery as
no way.
He felt the evidence due to be given was not befitting of a lady.
Wow.
Although the women took some persuasion to leave. They weren't happy at all that they'd miss out on the scandalous detail. But most of the headlines read, dope selling allegations in dance hall scandal. with strap lines like police stories of drunken orgies in West End, men dressed as women. And one newspaper printed that the scandalous evidence, which was, quote, there were then presented about 250 men and 50 women. The women were scantily clothed, whilst many of the men were dressed as women. Their faces were powdered, their cheeks were rouged, and lipstick had been used. They were singing, shouting, and pulling each other about. According to the description of the police, the scene was a disgusting and unnatural orgy. I mean, to me, this just takes me back to my times in GOY Astoria,
yeah.
The GOY for the young'uns, and the classic Night in Heaven.
Exactly.
But you've got to remember at the time, this is like the early 1920s, so this for them is quite scandalous. And during the police investigation, a pile of letters are discovered, some of which are complaints about what's going on inside the Adelphi Rooms on Edgware Road. One letter reads, quote, these boys dress up like women, old and young alike, and carry vanity bags on their arms, bags which are well filled with powder and paint. It is neither more nor less than a respectable brothel. Anyhow, the police had attended this club, the Adelphi Rooms on Edgware Road, which is no longer there, it's been demolished, and they gave an account of what they witnessed, and I quote, in the refreshment room and elsewhere, mostly men were dancing, shouting, screaming, and singing. Some were behaving suggestively, that were the little twinks. Men were kissing each other openly, and women were treated with familiarity. But if you want to read the full story, head over to the blog. It's got its own little section on there, because it is quite an interesting read, actually.
But does Martin citing this case help his case by claiming them to be similar?
When you read the whole of that story, I suspect that the gap between the cases of 1926 and Martin's own case now in 1982, that's 56 years. And I can't help but wonder if citing verbal gay history that's perhaps got distorted over the years and the decades, but is still remembered by the gay community as being significant, or if he's merely highlighting that 56 years on, gay men are still being somewhat persecuted by the police simply for being gay and for being who they are.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the article continues. Mr. Johnson claimed 15 guests were crammed into one cell, 9 in another, and 13 in a third at Acton Police Station. He added he was questioned about his sexual relationships and invitations to the party, which mentioned a Dionysiac orgy. Mr. Johnson said he believed the police were called by a guest who caused trouble at the party and had been thrown out. Shortly afterwards, he found a policeman coming up the stairs. Mr. Johnson, who was wearing a black vest and shorts, was allowed to put on warmer clothing and then arrested. Mr. Johnson, a travel manager, said, I do not think a lot of the public are really aware of what's going on. There are a lot of gay people in Chiswick, and it could easily happen again.
So, it seems a disgruntled guest who was kicked out called the police.
Seems so.
I'm relieved Martin and his guests weren't charged. But surely that means they'd not broken the law to be charged.
Exactly. And sadly, there was nothing else in the newspaper's archives to understand what actually happened. But...
ooh, I hope this is a good but.
Yes, it is, for us anyway. Because on the 8th of April 1983, around 6 months after the police raid and arrest of Martin and of his guests, Martin Johnson versus the United Kingdom is a claim brought to the European Court of Human Rights.
Oh, yes! Go, Martin! Should we get comfy?
Yes, get comfy, because it's an 11-page document that I'm going to read, but it is on the blog if anybody wants to read all 11 pages, because I can't read them all.
Okay.
But it comes in four parts. One, Martin puts forward his complaint. Two, the UK government responds to Martin's complaint. Three, Martin gets to respond to the government's response. And four, the European Court of Human Rights gives its decision.
Is Martin representing himself?
No. He has a barrister called Peter Ashman representing him, and he was an incredibly influential in all legal matters around gay rights and gay activism. Now, I viewed his details of this case from the archive that he submitted to the Bishop Gay Institution upon his death in 2014.
And is this right? The European Court hears the claim in July 1986?
Yes, 1986. It wasn't a fast process. 3 years and 3 months. Right, let's get stuck in. So when Martin's presenting his case, he sets out his argument under the heading, The Facts. And it states, on the night of the 3rd of October 1982, the applicant held a party to which he had invited some 40 people, all of whom were homosexual, as was the applicant himself. The applicant states that no person under the age of 21 were invited and that, to his knowledge, none were present. Between 2 a.m. and 2:30 a.m, the police entered the flat where the party was still in progress. Various items were removed from the applicant's bedroom and the applicant and 37 guests were arrested and taken to the police station.
Oh, man.
Now, just to break away for a minute,
okay.
I think it's fair to raise the point, given Martin nor the court share, that Martin's actual birthday was Friday the 1st of October 1982, when he turned 28 years old. Now, Saturday night was the 2nd of October 1982, and still today, traditionally, Saturday is the favoured night for such celebrations.
Yeah.
Meaning, when the police entered Martin's home between 2 a.m. and 2:30 a.m, it was, as they state, Sunday the 3rd of October 1982. Now, I only feel it's fair to say so many guests were at Martin's home, likely attending Martin's birthday celebrations, and not that Martin had just organised a random social gathering, or as the newspapers implied, a random gay orgy.
Yeah, I Anyhow, agree.
Back to the European Court of Human Rights, where Martin continues to set out the facts of his case. On being arrested, the applicant, Martin, was accused of permitting homosexual acts to take place at the party contrary to the Sexual Offences Act 1956, as amended by the Sexual Offences Act 1967. The police carried out the raid under their general powers to enforce legislation on reasonable suspicions of offences, in this case, offences against these acts. The 1956 Act, an act consolidating the existing statute law, made it an offence for any person to commit buggery with another person or animal, section 12, and an offence for a man to commit an act of gross indecency with another man, section 13. Section 1, subsection 1, of the 1967 Act provides that a homosexual act in private shall not be an offence provided that the parties consent thereto have attained the age of 21 years.
Okay.
By section 1, subsection 2, it is provided that an act which would otherwise be treated for the purposes of this act as being done in private shall not be so treated if done, A, when more than two persons take part or are present, or B, in a lavatory to which the public are permitted to have access, whether on payment or otherwise. The applicant was questioned about his homosexuality and detained until 11:30 a.m. the same morning. No prosecutions were subsequently brought, the applicant being informed in December 1982 by his solicitors that the police would not press charges. The applicant and his guests, however, had been upset and frightened by events, and the publicity in the press caused further distress. The applicant believes the publicity surrounding the raid played a decisive part in the withdrawal of an offer of permanent employment at the firm of travel agents, which he was on probationary service.
Well, for the time, it's bound to have affected his employment.
Oh, exactly. Even more so, given it was a local paper, you know, and it was the front page with a photograph of Martin. Anyhow, the court goes on to state that Martin is claiming that there were two breaches of his human rights. The first, Article 8, protects your right to respect for your private life, your family life, your home and your correspondence.
Yeah.
The applicant submits that the raid on his home was an interference by a public authority with his rights to respect for his private life and his home. The party was a private social occasion which took place in his home and to which the general public had no access. This interference was authorised by the Sexual Offences Act 1956, as amended by the Sexual Offences Act 1967. And the second breach of his human rights is Article 14, Protection from Discrimination. The applicant complains that there is clear inequality of treatment in his enjoyment of the right to respect for his private life and home, since the legislation only applies to male homosexuals. Adult male and female heterosexuals and adult female homosexuals may conduct themselves in the privacy of their home as regards their consensual sexual activities without such a risk of interference.
In short, Martin's arguing that Article 8 means he should be able to hold a private party in his own home despite being a gay man and more than two gays being present. And Article 14, that only gay men are subject to this Sexual Offences Act 1967, And therefore discrimination occurs because heterosexuals nor lesbians are subject to this law in their homes.
Basically, yes. And he's got a point, clearly, because this law doesn't exist today. Anyhow, the juicy bit probably is the fact that next, the UK government responds to the claim. At approximately 2:25 a.m. on the 3rd of October 1982, acting on information received that acts of buggery and gross indecency were taking place at the applicant's address between groups of men, some of whom were under 21, a number of police officers went to investigate. Finding the door open, they entered and found a party going on. Groups of men were in all the rooms, talking, holding hands, and cuddling. The police officers entered the bedroom where they saw six men naked or only partly clothed. Surely they're either naked or partly clothed. No, you can't have both. Anyhow, two of whom were getting up from one of the mattresses lying on the floor. The guests, of whom there were about 30, were interviewed. A number of them gave false details and in consequence, all were arrested and taken to Acton Police Station. Although one of the guests was under 21, he took no part in any sexual activity. The applicant was questioned at the police station and then was released pending further inquiries. The applicant was not charged. The government originally stated in their observations that the applicant was charged under Section 13 with procuring other men to commit acts of gross indecency, but the government have since stated this to be an error. 2 months later, after the police had put the case to their solicitor and had been advised as to the difficulties of proof, the applicant was informed no further action would be taken in respect of this incident.
I thought the police needed a warrant to enter someone's home.
The government argues that the law states anyone under 21 years old taking part in a homosexual act with someone over 21, the older of the two men is subject to 5 years in prison and therefore the act was an, quote, arrestable offence. And under the Criminal Law Act 1967, it states, and I quote, where a constable with reasonable cause suspects that an arrestable offence has been committed, he may arrest without warrant anyone whom he, with reasonable cause, suspects to be guilty of the offence. And with that, they say the legislation states a police officer can enter the premises to make that arrest without a warrant.
That's interesting.
And in its response, the government states, and I quote, the government submits that the powers of entry and arrest were exercised in relation to the arrestable offences of committing a homosexual act and the procuring of such acts, and therefore were clearly for the twin aims of, quote, protection of morals and the, quote, protection of the rights and freedoms of others, in particular of males under 21. A new consideration has emerged recently with the spread of the disease AIDS, which makes it clear that on the grounds of protection of health, the procuring of promiscuous homosexual acts should remain discouraged by the criminal law.
Man.
The government submits that none of the matters complained of amounted to a breach of Article 8, Paragraph 1. It is essential to bear in mind that the police entered the applicant's flat because they suspected with reasonable cause that arrestable offences were being committed there, i.e. males of or over 21 were committing homosexual acts with males under 21. The police arrested the applicant because they reasonably suspected him of procuring such offences.
So what happened next?
Before Peter Ashman submits a final response on behalf of Martin and goes through the government's response. Now, this is where the Bishop Gay Institute comes in because they hold the Peter Ashman Memorial Archive and within it is the case on Martin Johnson. I had in my hand the original response from the government, and Peter has clearly sat down with Martin and gone through it because he's made some notes. In some instances, Martin's obviously adding clarity or he's confirming or denying something.
Yeah.
So I've just picked out a few pieces which I think will allow us to understand what the facts are direct from Martin via Peter. So here they are.
Okay.
So when the government stated in its response, quote, acting on information received acts of buggery and gross indecency were taking place at 110 Esmond Road, Acton, between groups of men, some of whom were under 21, Peter's written in biro, person checked out, Eugene admitted it to person staying with before going back to Belfast.
That's what we'd call today a shady bitch.
Well, I think you're being too nice. I'd actually call him a shady cunt. But regardless, this shady bitch has gone back to Belfast. Now, here's a little insight into what happened when the police arrived, because it said once they received the tip-off, the 12 police officers went to the property and found some men outside number 110, one being sick over the garden wall and a couple talking with their arms around each other. The front door was open and the officers entered. So that's the scene when they arrived, which I think is fabulous, actually. You know, one being sick. One being sick over the garden wall. Oh, it's fabulous. And the government's response goes on. And again, there's no notes against this. So Martin's clearly quite happy that it's factual. You know, he's not confirming or denying anything. So it goes on to say, number 110 was a first floor flat, which it still is today, actually, occupied by the applicant, so Martin Johnson, and another man. So this may indicate he was in a relationship or he may have been lodging. You know, we don't know. There was a party going on there at the time to celebrate the applicant's birthday. This is what I said earlier.
Yeah.
No? The officers found groups of men in all of the rooms of the flat, talking, holding hands and cuddling each other, which we got in the court report. Hmm. The bedroom door was closed. Huh. When an officer approached the room, he saw a man open the door and appear to give a warning shout to persons inside. Sellotaped, this is fabulous, sellotaped to the door was a handwritten notice. Quote, do not obstruct the door. Ah. This causes delay and can be frustrating. Oh, gosh, love it. Love it, love it, love it. Oh, it's fantastic. When the door was open fully, the officer saw six men naked or partly clothed. Now, Peter's written a little side note that says, none said naked. So Martin's done his own asking around and nobody said that they were naked.
Okay.
Two of whom on the far side of the room were getting up from lying on mattresses. The other four stood. And this is where it gets a little bit difficult in regards to this document.
Really?
Because all the other lines of the page, as it's been typed out by a typewriter, are all nicely spaced. However, there's a section that's squashed in between two lines here, which just makes it a little bit odd. So if I was to read it naturally without this extra line that's been added in, it seems after, it would state, the other four stood in a line to the officer's right. The room was dimly lit. On the floor were a number of mattresses. Now, they've added in this line, this extra line, which so it now reads, the other four stood, one of them with an erect penis. Now, Peter's written a little note that says after that, nobody had an erect penis. So it really does give a hint. We know this went on. The police or government were a little bit shady in parts in trying to elaborate. And it seems to me here that given all the, I mean, go and check it out on the blog yourself. It's page number 2. But it could have been that this was just missed when it was typed, or it could have just been added in afterwards to try and make this case sound a lot more seedy than it actually was.
I agree.
And in regards to the, on the floor were a number of mattresses, Peter has written in his own hand, only one mattress, because it was then and it is today a one-bedroom flat. It's a leasehold as well, so either Martin owned the flat or his partner owned the flat. And I say a partner because they're obviously living together somehow because, unless he was sleeping on the sofa, because there's one bed, there's one mattress in the property.
Yeah.
So the government's response goes on the floor were a number of mattresses, which we've cleared up was only one, and the following items, various tubes of lubricating jelly, jars of Vaseline, bottles of amyl nitrate, brackets, used as a stimulant, close bracket, and some towels. So Martin hasn't objected to the tubes of lubricating jelly. Huh. In regards to jars of Vaseline, plural, he's put one. So there's one jar of Vaseline. In regards to bottles of amyl nitrate, he's actually written in no amyl nitrate and some towels. And there's no note against the towels. So this must have been the setup. I just think it's brilliant. And the next part, which is section 1.4 of the government's response, reads, the guests at the party, of whom there were about 30, were interviewed. A number of them gave false details. In consequence, all were arrested and taken to Acton Police Station, as was the applicant.
Ah.
Now, Peter's little notes here are quite interesting. Where the government states, a number of them gave false details.
Yeah.
Above it, Peter has written in, no, nothing about this. So Martin knows nothing about whether they gave false details or not. I think at the time, and even retrospectively, we know that gay men often give false details because they didn't want this getting back to whoever.
Yeah.
Because they would be seriously criminalised and penalised for it, you know, when essentially they're not doing anything wrong, although not in the eyes of the law at the time. And also in regards to the men giving false details, Peter has also added, how police knew at this stage didn't check addresses until 7 or 8 a.m., which is the following morning, because don't forget this is early hours of the morning, it's 2:30 in the morning.
Huh.
How do they know that the men gave false addresses? they didn't check their addresses until 7 or 8 a.m. when they're already in the police station. And that's when they've established some of them are given false details. And the next section of page 2 of this document that the Bishopgate Institute have kindly allowed us to publish on the blog, so you can go and check it out and see it for yourself, courtesy of the Peter Ashman Memorial Archive, section 1.5 states, and I think this is fabulous, some of the guests were found to be in possession of party invitations, quote, capital letters, you are invited to attend Martin's Dionysi birthday orgy. Come, C-U-M, play and lay till late. Bring a bottle, 110 Esmond Road, Chiswick, and then there's a phone number. I think it's just fabulous. Now, whether I pronounce this word Dionysi correctly or not, the Collins English Dictionary states that it's associated with the word Dionysius, which is an ancient Greek word. And it relates to the god of winemaking.
That's interesting.
I mean, Martin did say bring a bottle. And the interesting thing is, there's no notes from Peter where Martin perhaps takes issue that people have got these invitations, that they're stating that these invitations said this.
Mm.
And then on page 3 of this document, in the government's response, section 1.6, although one of the guests was under 21, he took no part in any sexual activity. Now, Peter putting this to Martin, he has written in his own hand, there was someone there, Italian, brought along by guest, visitor from Milan, aged 20. And then he's put another note that says, and I'm assuming this is in the reference when everybody was arrested in the police station.
Okay.
Let him go early to catch plane.
Oh.
So he's obviously going back to Milan or to Italy.
Yeah.
So in regards to this story as a whole, we've obviously got the newspapers saying that it was an orgy, and I think we could probably... I mean, the use of the word orgy was on the invitation. Was it an orgy as such? I think it was a birthday party with a room set aside for men to go and, you know, have a little bit of extra fun in the safety of Martin's home.
So what happened next?
So Martin and his barrister, having heard the government's arguments, and no doubt on the advice of his barrister Peter Ashman, submits a final response before the court decides the case. And Peter isn't going down without a fight.
Awesome.
Much of it is legal arguments, so anyone interested should go read it. I've picked out snippets that will allow us to understand more of what actually happened. So in Martin's response to the government, we get the facts, round 2, where his response states, the police decided to raid the applicant's home on the basis of information from an anonymous telephone caller. This caller had in fact been evicted from the applicant's party because of his rude, aggressive behaviour. He admitted to a friend of the applicant that he had made the call in order to get his revenge. So Eugene, if you hear this, then get in touch and tell us why. Why did you grass up poor Martin?
Exactly.
Anyhow, the facts continue. And in Martin's second response, he states, the applicant disputes the government's description of the scene in his bedroom. His own subsequent inquiries suggested that one person was on the bed, undressed, but all the others were clothed. There was only one mattress in the bedroom, because in the government's response, they said mattresses.
Yeah.
Implying that, you know, he's arranged this orgy, he's got all his mattresses lying around, and he was living in a one-bedroom flat. So I think it's probably quite fair to assume one-bedroom flat, he's got one bed. And that's probably the one mattress.
Yeah, because the government claimed mattresses plural.
Exactly it, you know, and it wasn't the case. And Martin's response continues. The applicant states that he did not invite anyone under the age of 21. He has since learned that an Italian man aged 20 had been brought along to the party by one of those invited.
There was, as the caller claimed, someone under the age of 21.
Yes, and this one person out of 37... and not invited by Martin, but brought along by a guest. Don't read too much into that for the moment, because Martin's barrister goes on to argue in the response, the applicant denies that he was charged before release. He was not provided with a written statement of charge, nor was he bailed by the police as would normally be the case. The applicant invites the government to supply proof that he was so charged. And in brackets, he goes on to state, the government has subsequently accepted that the applicant was not charged.
Mm.
After his release, the applicant contacted his solicitor, who advised him immediately to prepare a record of what had transpired, which the applicant did the same day. The applicant recorded that all the questions of the police were directed towards his own sexual activities, what activities had been going on or would be allowed at his party. He was not asked about the ages of the people at the party. Now, the government in its argument kept referring to the 1967 Act in regards to procuring, and Martin's barrister, Peter, addressed this as follows. The offence of procuring acts of gross indecency as governed by Section 13 of the Sexual Offences Act 1956 can only be committed by a man. A woman commits no offence if she procures such an act,
yeah,
whether the act is legal or illegal. The applicant refers to the definition of procuring set out in R v Broadfoot 1977. In this case, Mr. Justice Cusack stated that it had been properly defined as to produce by endeavour, to recruit, to bring about a course of conduct which the person in question would not have embarked on spontaneously of their own volition. In this case, Martin's case, all of the persons at the applicant's party were there of their own free will, and none had been persuaded to participate in unlawful homosexual acts against their will. Therefore, the applicant, Martin, could not have been convicted of procurement if everybody was a willing participant.
Well said.
The reason why the police raided the applicant's party was not because of any suspicion of a possible offence of procurement, but because of suspicions about illegal homosexual acts, i.e. more than two persons engaging in homosexual acts, some of whom were under 21. The applicant does not dispute that where there is a genuine case of procuring an offence, i.e. persuading someone to commit a criminal offence which he would not normally be willing to commit, then the enforcement of the law may be justified under Article 8. However, there is no pressing social need for a separate offence under Section 13. There have hardly been any prosecutions. It can be committed only by a man, and its existence can only be used by the public authorities to interfere with the private lives of homosexual men whenever more than two gather for a social occasion in their homes. But since in this application no offence of procuring has been committed and none suspected before the raid, the question of procuring is largely irrelevant.
And what about the 20-year-old guest?
Well, Martin's barrister Peter comes onto this next, where he makes the following argument. The only guest under 21 was a visitor from Italy. Italian law does not discriminate in respect of the age of consent for sexual activity, the age of 16 being fixed as the age of consent for all consensual acts, homosexual or heterosexual. Neither does Italian law prohibit private sexual acts involving more than two people. It is illogical to argue that the police raid aimed at protecting his health or morals,
yeah,
or his rights and freedoms by preventing him doing what his national law had permitted him freely to do for several years and what he would be able to do in almost every other member state of the Council of Europe. Now, in response to the government's arguments around AIDS, Martin's barrister Peter goes on to state, the government further suggests that interference is justified by seeking to prevent the spread of AIDS, yet the government's own advertising makes it clear that AIDS is transmitted by a variety of means. It is found to a considerable degree amongst drug addicts and haemophiliacs, yet there are no special legal restrictions on their sexual activities. Concern for the health of the persons at the applicant's party was not one of the police considerations in raiding it. And Peter concludes his argument by stating, the applicant submits he has suffered clear discrimination in the enjoyment of his rights under Article 8, taken together with Article 14, which has no reasonable or objective justification. 1. Only homosexual men may be prosecuted for engaging in sexual relations in private with more than two persons present in the room. 2. Only men, whether hetero or homosexual, may be prosecuted for procuring homosexual acts, whether such acts are illegal or illegal. It leaves homosexual men at risk of interference by the public authorities wherever free or more gather together socially. There have scarcely been any prosecutions since it was enacted, yet its existence enables the public authorities to interfere in private lives in such a way that, as in the present application, it can result in loss of liberty, loss of employment, loss of friends, and loss of reputation. For these reasons, the applicant submits that his rights under the convention have been violated.
Exciting. Peter makes Martin. A good case on behalf of Martin and, I guess, the 37 men. What did the European Court of Human Rights decide?
Okay, are you ready?
Get on with it. We want to know what the court ruled.
Okay. The decision reads, the Commission will consider in turn whether the entry and arrests which followed or the legislation constitute an interference with the applicant's rights under Article 8. The raid. The Commission recalls that on the morning of 3rd of October 1982, a number of police officers entered the applicant's flat, where he was holding a, quote, gay party, seized items from his bedroom, and after arresting the applicant and his guest, took them to the police station, where they were questioned about their activities. However, the Commission is not required to decide whether or not the facts alleged by the applicant disclose any appearance of a violation of this provision, as Articles 26 of the Convention provides that the Commission, quote, may only deal with the matter within a period of 6 months from the date of which the final decision was taken. Since, however, it is accepted that the entry and arrests were lawfully carried out, the applicant had no effective remedy open to him in the English courts. Where no domestic remedy is available, the six-month period runs from the date of which the act itself alleged to be in violation of the Convention. In the present case, the incidents complained of took place on the 3rd of October 1982, whereas the application was submitted to the Commission on the 8th of April 1983. That is more than 6 months after the date of the incident. Furthermore, an examination of the case does not disclose the existence of any special circumstances which might have interrupted or suspended the running of that period. It follows that this part of the application has been introduced out of time and must be rejected under Article 27, Paragraph 3 of the Convention.
Man. So Martin just missed the deadline for this part of his claim to be considered.
Yes, and it stinks, doesn't it? It's, I mean, fair's fair. The application wasn't made in time, but oh, it's just rotten. It just stinks. Anyhow, the decision by the European Courts of Human Rights goes on to state, the applicant also complains of the provision which makes it illegal for homosexual acts to be committed when more than two persons take part or are present. The Commission notes that a person who commits homosexual acts in such circumstances or procures others to do so would be liable on first conviction to a maximum sentence of 2 years imprisonment. These offences were therefore not, quote, arrestable offences within the meaning of Section 2 of the Criminal Law Act 1967, and the police do not have the power to arrest without warrant or to enter a home for that purpose. It would have been necessary for the police to have laid an information before a magistrate who would decide whether or not a warrant should be issued. The Commission further notes that the entry into the applicant's apartment was not made on the suspicion that an offence against this provision was being committed. The Commission recalls that the applicant has not alleged that he is disposed to the commission of homosexual acts when more than two persons take part or are present. Nor is there evidence that such acts took place in the applicant's home on the 3rd of October 1982. The Commission therefore concludes that there is no indication that in the personal circumstances of the applicant, the existence of the legislative provision making it an offence to commit an homosexual act when more than two persons take part or are present continuously and directly affects his private life or his home. Accordingly, the existence of this legislation does not constitute an interference with his rights to respect for a private life or his home. It therefore follows that this part of the application is manifestly ill-founded within the meaning of Article 27, Paragraph 2 of the Convention.
Oh. I really thought he was winning, and then just at the end, ah! But it's interesting they disagreed with the UK government, who argues the police were permitted to enter Martin's home without a warrant.
Yeah, so did I. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a really good outcome. But, I mean, if Martin hadn't challenged it through this court, then he'd have believed that they were right, that they could just enter his home willy-nilly and without a warrant, which didn't prove to be the case. Anyhow, the Commission now moves on to Article 14 and the rights regarding discrimination, where they state in their decision, The applicant further complains that he suffers discrimination in his enjoyment of the right to respect for his private life and the home, since the legislation only applies to male homosexuals. He complains that adult heterosexuals and female homosexuals may conduct themselves in the privacy of their homes as regards consensual sexual activities without such risk of interference. Again, the Commission, while recognising the changing and developing views on the issue of age of consent for male homosexuals, sees no reason to depart from its previous decisions and is of the opinion that the test of proportionality is satisfied in the facts of the present application. Accordingly, the Commission finds that the difference in treatment resulting from legal provisions prohibiting homosexual relations under the age of 21 does not constitute discrimination under Article 14 of the Convention. It follows that this part of the application must be dismissed as manifestly ill-founded within the meaning of Article 27, Paragraph 2 of the Convention.
Oh, man.
The applicant has also complained of discrimination in relation to this legislation, which makes it an offence for homosexual acts to be committed in the presence of more than two adult males. No analogous provisions applying to adult female homosexuals or heterosexuals. The Commission further recalls that the police could not act on suspicion of such offences involving more than two adult males without first gaining a warrant from a magistrate. The Commission finds that the measures of enforcement which can be taken in relation to such offences are proportional to the end sought to be realised. It follows that on the facts of the present case, there is no appearance of a violation of Article 14, read in conjunction with Article 8, and this part of the application must also be dismissed as manifestly ill-founded with the meaning of Article 27, Paragraph 2. For this reason, the Commission declares the application inadmissible.
Not the result I was hoping for. But Martin put up a good fight for what he believed
in. Oh, do you know? I'm exhausted just reading it. I cannot begin to imagine what Martin Johnson had to endure preparing and waiting and experience what he had done for over 3 years just to receive that result. It just must have been soul destroying. But I think you've got to look at this, and I hope Martin looked at this, and I hope he really kind of, you know, reassured him that at least he tried.
Yeah, I agree.
But, you know, even though Martin lost his claim here, none of those laws exist today. So truly, Martin was right. Yeah, he may have not have won in this claim here, but he is a winner, essentially, because he was one of the first vocal people to challenge the UK government and the legislation.
I agree.
Martin Johnson, you're a legend.
So, this decision comes on July 17th, 1986. Fast forward, or in our case, rewind 2.5 years to the beginning of this episode.
And Martin Johnson, on the 24th of February 1989, is presenting the late Diana, Princess of Wales, with flowers before sitting down with her for a chat while he is resident at the Mildmay Hospital AIDS Hospice. Sadly, 12 days after meeting Princess Diana, Martin passed away aged 34 at the Mildmay Mission Hospital, East London.
That is sad.
Born on the 1st of October 1954 in Muswell Hill to parents Derek and Marion Johnson, Martin Aston Johnson, as we heard, carved out a career as a travel agent. Martin's mother Marion held her son's hand as he slipped away on the 12th of March 1989. The cause of death was recorded as 1A, left ventricular failure, otherwise known as heart failure, and B, Kaposi sarcoma, which presented itself in the photographs that we saw of Martin with the late Princess Diana. Martin's usual address upon the death certificate is given as Mildmay Mission Hospital, given the hospital housed the UK's first AIDS hospice. Martin would have no doubt been the one to decide to reside in the unit to receive care, knowing, with no effective treatment nor cure, that his life was perhaps coming to an end.
Incredibly sad. 34 is no age, is it?
Incredibly sad. You see it time and time again with many of these men, this generation of men, they're all incredibly young. I mean, 34, again, is no age. He had so much ahead of him. While it's no consolation to see Martin so excited to meet the princess in this very short clip, will have no doubt been a welcome distraction and a moment for him to treasure, given what he knew he was facing. And thankfully, with the team at Mildmay and his mother Marion by his side, he didn't have to face it alone.
No, I'll stand up and she presents in a sheet. come through the door.
You're presenting Sam Young?
Yes.
I just did.
All good, boss.
All
great.
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in do you believe in life after love? Oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.